Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. I have with me Tyler Christofoli. He's back on again, and basically one of my favorite paramedics out there. And we are talking about cognitive stop points. And Tyler, before we get too far into this, why don't you reintroduce yourself again?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, brother. I am Tyler Christofoli from the Foam Frat blog and podcast. I live up here in Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, right on the border of Minnesota. I work as a flight paramedic, a new flight paramedic for LifeLink 3, and I'm about 2 months in being a flight medic now. I went from working ground critical care, and I love to teach. I love to talk about critical care medicine, emergency medicine, and I appreciate you having me on again, man.
Yeah, no problem. I notice you're not pronouncing Minnesota the way I anticipate people up there pronouncing that. It's Minnesota.
You know what? I was just at the Metro Atlanta EMS conference, and everybody there told me that I have the most Canadian accent they've ever heard, which blows my mind away because I moved from Florida to North Carolina to Wisconsin, and now I'm right on that border, and I don't feel like I have an accent, but everyone else thinks I do. But I guess in contrast to a southern accent, maybe I do. Maybe I sound more like a youper, as they would say.
It's funny that you mentioned that because when I was in the UK, I was confused for an Australian. I don't know if it was because this is more towards the end of my time there. If I just started picking up a bit of the English accent, that combined with the ignorant American accent as they kind of look at it, that I must have just sounded that way to them. But I was confused for being an Australian.
No, that's a lot cooler than Canadian. I shouldn't say that, but you know, I'd like to have an Australian accent.
All right, so I think we're almost sidetracked with the banner. So let's talk about what we're actually here for, and that is again cognitive stop points. And I guess Tyler, when I say that, what does that make you think?
So in the typical sense of a cognitive stop point, and I think the way you hear it used most of the time in emergency medicine is a patient in which your interventions are refractory. They are not working. And you're trying to figure out, where do I go from here? And a lot of times people just keep throwing everything in the kitchen sink at a patient, trying to figure out how to fix them. Why am I not getting the results that I want to see? And they have built in this cognitive stop point where hopefully somebody, and it's usually takes a well-disciplined person to step away and say, okay, what is going on right now? Let's stop. Let's take a time out and let's figure out what we need to do. Where are we going wrong? And this is kind of how the typical sense of a cognitive stop point or a timeout has been portrayed. I use it a little bit different because I do it on every single assignment and I will bump it up quicker in the assignment if I have those treatments that are not working. But I like to take some time right before I give a radio report. That's usually my moment. I take a minute before I say everything out loud. This is what I think is going on with the patient. These are all the interventions that we've done. Anybody have any other ideas? No. And then we go ahead and I give my report to the hospital. So that kind of reminds me, it's a little built-in kind of a landmark that, Tyler, you need to stop, gather your thoughts. Is there anything you want to do? Is your sedation appropriate? Did you think about TXA already? You know, your tourniquets are all working. Everything's fine. Your peak pressures, your plateau pressures, everything looks good. All right, give that report to the hospital.
So let's think through. I basically broke it up into four sections, four basic points, and about how to use this. And the first part is really just saying out loud that you don't know what's going on anymore or that you need help, whatever is really the one that's more applicable. Because sometimes you know what's going on, but you realize, well, I don't have the resources I need, and we'll tie that into a second, but you know that there's something more that you need to do. There's something that is right there. You need something else to have happen.
Yeah, I think saying it out loud is extremely important. Just taking a few steps back and thinking to yourself, what's going on with this patient? That doesn't really do the same as if you actually say out loud, okay, guys, I'm lost. You know, I don't know what's going on right now. And that puts everyone on a level playing ground to where they all say, all right, cool, this is an idea I had. I just wasn't going to say anything because I thought you knew. So now we all start from scratch and we rebuild up with only the facts, what we know for sure.
And so this ties in nicely with the encouraging discussion and brainstorming side of this. This is what exactly we're wanting to do. And we want this to be non-judgmental. Even if someone says something like, no, 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 that doesn't make sense. Like, you already asked and opened up for the help. At least consider it. Because most likely, if you're at this point, it's because of some assumptions we made, which we'll get to in just a second. But the second point is about mobilizing your resources early. Can you kind of explain what we're talking about, Tyler?
So in the hospital, that's probably going to be different than it is for us in the field. If you're an ALS service and you know you're going to have to fly a patient, you know, you get that helicopter en route. If you know you're going to blow through your oxygen that's on the cot because it wasn't all the ways full, you get somebody getting that oxygen ready so you have that for your intubation. You start doing a pre-mortem checklist where you say, what is everything that could possibly go wrong? What is everything that I would possibly need? And then you start fulfilling that and totally take that out of the equation so you don't have to worry about that during the resuscitation or after the resuscitation.
And you're right, it's going to be a little different for us. It's the same basic principles because you're basically mobilizing specialists or equipment or those types of things. And in a sense, the specialist is going to be the flight crew, unless I guess you're the flight crew. And then what's the number for 911? How does that work? But really what you're going to end up doing is you're going to try and mobilize some sort of effort. So on the hospital side of things, if it's someone who's trauma and really needs a surgeon, you want to make sure your surgeon's on the way. It's kind of like going back to basic BLS. If you never call for help in the first place, that ambulance is never going to come, right? So it's the same kind of idea. Or if you need the difficult airway cart and it wasn't already in the room for whatever reason, whatever the case may be, you just need to make sure that those resources are on their way. And a lot of times, if you are really good and you're in an otherwise optimal situation, you may not need those resources, but it's better to mobilize them early than not have them at all.
Yeah, and then you don't have to worry about it. It's already done. You've already set off your stroke alert or your trauma alert. And when you get tied up in that patient, you're not going to have to worry about that after the thought.
So Tyler, let's talk about the third point, and that is you're going to start over and remove all assumptions.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because sometimes different people fall into the resuscitation at different times. So the first responders get there first for us. Then you have an ALS or BLS service that shows up, and then we'll show up afterwards. We're usually the last ones as a flight crew, and we get in the back of the ambulance and they say, yeah, we got the patient intubated, or we have given this and this and this. And we really got to stop and say, okay, you know, let's make sure that that tube is in the trachea. Let's make sure that the monitor's on. Let's make sure that that pulse ox is actually what their pulse ox is and it didn't fall off their finger, or it's not on the same arm as the blood pressure cuff and it's cutting restriction to it. Let's start over. And let's say, what do we absolutely know about this patient? And that really shows why it's good to do your own assessment as well. We're not invalidating anything that that previous crew did, but something's obviously not working because we have a patient that is starting to decompensate or starting to crash, and we are trying to intervene. And at that point, it makes sense for us all to say, let's strip away everything we assume and build these blocks back up strictly on facts.
The way I like to think about it is nothing but the facts. That's all I want to start off with, and then we will work from there. And this may be sometimes patients who come through the front door and maybe were managed by someone else, or maybe the story doesn't add up. Or the other thing is maybe the labs don't even add up. Maybe we see something there, we're like, this doesn't look like this patient. Again, you're not treating labs, you're treating the patient itself. So you got to think about that. Maybe the labs were drawn incorrectly. Maybe there was some sort of issue down in the lab. Those things all happen. The other thing that I keep in mind is sometimes, and I don't mean this in any offense, Tyler, so don't be offended, but sometimes the pre-hospital crew come in with their own assumptions and talk about certain things. And then, you know, after they've left and I've talked to them and I thought I got a good story from them, next thing I know, something's going to hell and I don't know why. And so I have to oftentimes step back and reconsider, did I get the right information? What assumptions were they making to get that information in the first place to me? And okay, let's remove all this and let's start over and let's only work off the facts that we actually have.
And things change. You know, we are in a very dynamic atmosphere where, yeah, the tube was in initially, and it came out when we moved them to your bed.
Oh, see how you blamed me there? I caught that.
It's never our fault, man. You know that. I mean, as soon as we move them over to your bed, then the PA or the nurse pulled out the tube. It's not us. And even though we told you, yeah, our end-tidal CO2 is not working. We never got end-tidal CO2. But the tube's in, man. You know it's in. It's just our capnography is not working.
All right. So I think we could both admit, like, we both sides screw up. It happens. So, you know, ultimately, though, realistically, what we're talking about is that we just need to work off what we actually know versus what we think we know, which kind of moves on to the fourth and final kind of step in all this with cognitive stop points. And that's to troubleshoot in a methodical manner. And I think of this like an engineer. You know, engineers, when they go through problems, proper engineers, they're going in a stepwise approach. They're going through each part of this. And we talk about acronyms sometimes, and both Tyler and I have a method. One thing we can talk about too is DOPES, the crashing intubated patient, like going through the different steps of that. And, you know, no matter what step it is, we're following a stepwise approach to make sure that we've hit all the things that we need to do and that we've basically ruled them in or ruled them out with each step of the way.
Yeah, this is really important, because if you have a machine error or you have some sort of mechanical error or a tool error, you're going to intubate and your battery's dead on your video laryngoscope, or the light bulb went out, or you go in with your direct laryngoscopy and somebody forgot to put batteries in the laryngoscope, or the ventilator's not working, that can really throw you off. And you're already taking care of a critically ill patient. And then next thing, you're trying to troubleshoot some sort of equipment problem. So for one, it makes sense to know your equipment very well. And one of the things I used to do when I was the training officer at LifeStar is I would have the crews walk out of the room. I would do something to the ventilator. I'd take out the expiratory valve. I would shove a donut hole up the FiO2 sensor. I'd do something so that it would not work the way they wanted it to. And then I'd have them come back in and we'd start a clock and we'd video them and I'd have them troubleshoot and try to figure out what happened. And then the next step to really being good at troubleshooting is to go through and try to duplicate any alarms that you might get. So you try to reproduce those, because if you can reproduce the fluid side occlusion or the air in line on the pump or whatever problem you may see, then you know how to fix it. And so I think that's really important. And then when you're actually in the real life situation, I always like to start at the patient and work my way out to the machine, whether that be the ventilator circuit, the IV tubing, a chest tube. I start at the patient and then I work my way out.
Sounds great. And that's pretty much the same method I take. So overall, I mean, the key is to slow down and be methodical about your process. And that includes things like sometimes you are just so wound up in the second, especially if you're coming into this and everyone else is going a little crazy. You got to remember, you got to slow down and really think about things. And one easy thing to do is tactical breathing, of course.
Yeah, tactical breathing is a great tool. You know, also positive self-thoughts and using a positive mantra or whatever you have to remind yourself that we got this, we're good. Ginger Locke just did a talk at the Georgia EMS conference or the Atlanta EMS conference, and she did a phenomenal job with it. And she put up some different mantras that people use. Ashley Liebig, Non-Swami Nathan, different people put in what their mantra is that they say to themselves to try to maintain a positive outlook on it, because that's all you have. And as the team leader, everybody is really looking at you to make this run smooth. And they're going to look in your eyes, and the moment they see that you're scared, that's the moment that they're going to get scared as well, but they don't feel like they have a leader at that point. So it's really up to us to say, all right, team, we got this. One of the mantras was, this is a challenge, but we can do it. Ashley Liebig says she does a fist bump and says, we got this, and we do every time. You know, everybody's kind of got their own, but it's important to have that. So when you get to this point, you're not falling back and saying, man, I don't know what to do next. I just want the shift to be over. I just want to crawl in a corner or a hole and die. Need to stay positive about it.
So Tyler, with all this considered, I mean, basically, I think a nice way to tie this all in is to use the clinical case. And although this is something that is going to be in the hospital, you can use this at a hospital too. And this is just something I kind of drew up. By no means is this an actual patient. I took this from so many different patients and so many different scenarios that I have not done this specific scenario. So no issues with HIPAA, no issues with that, because it doesn't even exist. But it's just based off of some very similar things I've seen before. So let's go with that classic late night shift. You hear this call over the intercom system that says that the rapid response team is needed for one of the pediatric floor rooms. Usually this late in the hospital, you're the only provider there because, you know, all the hospitalists go home and stuff and they don't stick around. So you're going to be the one who is going there and you decide to respond. And per your protocols, you go with a tech and you go with a nurse as well. And you find this 4-month-old infant in extremis. I mean, they are sick. And weirdly enough, there is actually a hospitalist there, but it's one of the pediatricians. And at your facility, the pediatricians, they're not critical care, but they're just your good old-fashioned outpatient pediatrician who's come in and they're trying to manage the patient, and they're attempting to intubate this patient. And things really aren't going that well. One of the nurses there, they see you, they know who you are, they start telling you about how the patient was admitted a couple of days ago for pneumonia, that the mom woke up and the kid was in really bad distress and was just getting worse with time. And so they've already tried multiple intubation attempts without any success. Tyler, when you hear this situation, what goes through your mind?
So if I'm walking into a situation and I see a pediatrician who's already failed intubation 3 times, I want to know a couple things. I want to know, one, what has he done? Or was she done? What have they tried so far? Are they using a bougie? What size blade are they using? How would they describe that airway? Are they able to get a good view of the glottic opening? Have they not even been able to see the epiglottis? Are they getting secretions? I really want to start building a shared mental model with that pediatrician, so that way I don't just jump in and do the same exact thing that they just did. So that's my first step, is to communicate this. All right, pull out. Intubation's not working. Let's reoxygenate. While we're reoxygenating, let's have a nice, calm conversation about what you saw. Explain this airway to me in explicit detail. And that way, when we try to intubate this kid again, we have a shared mental model and we're not doing the same thing over and over again.
And essentially, this is like our first cognitive stop point, right? Because we're saying out loud that we don't know what's going on and that we're needing help. And in a sense, you could say, well, part of that is because the pediatrician's done that, because they've initiated the rapid response team. And part of it is you, because you don't know what's going on and you know that there's going to be additional resources that are needed. So in this scenario, for example, and of course, there's many different ways you can approach this, but I believe in going into our second point with the cognitive stop point. So that's mobilizing our resources early. So I want to make sure that we have our difficult airway car and ultrasound machine. You know, if we've got some sort of video laryngoscope, if it's not already at the bedside, that we've got all this stuff coming towards our way. And that we want to make sure, because this patient's sick enough, and like I said, we don't have a pediatric ICU. Well, hey, we're going to transfer this patient, so let's go ahead and get the flight crew coming. And depending on what's going on in that time, the flight crew may even be here in enough time to help us out. Usually not, but just depending on it, could be a possibility. And then getting other resources like a CRNA or respiratory therapy or x-ray or whoever else we need to come in to bring whatever other resources. All that ties in. And in that same time, we're getting the information. And this helps us out because we can better figure out what's going on while still accomplishing multiple points on our cognitive stop points.
Yeah, and our mobilization of resources is going to be obviously different, as we mentioned out in the head of this episode. Because as a flight crew, if we are jumping in the back of an ambulance and they've tried to intubate this kid 3 times, we don't have anyone else to call, right? So we have to figure out if intubation is necessary, if they've already pushed paralytics, or if they felt it was necessary. It probably is, and we need to do that shared mental model again, get a good idea of what they were doing, what tricks they were using, if they had used a bougie, how their positioning was, because it's really going to come down to us Making the decision, do we need to stick around and intubate, or do we try non-invasive? Do we throw in a supraglottic airway, which we use the eye gel? We could throw the eye gel in if we needed to, depending on the age or the king, and just get them to the hospital? Or is there something, does this kid need to be intubated right now? So those are the things that are kind of flowing through my brain.
Let's fast forward through our scenario a little bit. So you got everything set up and you got things going. Your first attempt, you decide to go direct laryngoscopy, and you can see you just can't get that tube to pass. Well, by then, fortunately, someone comes along with video laryngoscope. Hey, I can see things beautifully, get the tube to pass, and we're good, right? You know, that's all we need. They for some reason need a tube, but they're in bad respiratory distress. We got that figured out. You know, kid's doing, oh, crap. Tyler, the kid's not doing better. His oxygen saturations are still down 90%. So I don't know what's going on here anymore. So this is when I grab my handy-dandy ultrasound. And I don't know if you guys carry ultrasound in your helicopters yet. But for me, I'm going to look right away and confirm tube placement. And at the same time, I'm looking for other causes. So I look, I say, hey, I saw it went through the cords, and I know we're in good position. I look, and usually when you mainstem someone, right, you're going into the right, not usually the left, but you can see that nice right-sided movement, but on the left side, you see a pneumothorax, and you really don't believe, and like kind of judging around from things, you realize that, okay, you got a pneumo. Well, that makes a little more sense for why that patient's oxygen saturation, especially for a little kid, is not going up, right? So that's when you now are going into, you've removed your assumptions, you started with only the facts, you used the facts from the ultrasound, and you have now done your thoracostomy, and guess what? Kid's starting to do better.
Yeah, so I like the way you laid that out. You have a patient who is intubated, and we know that putting plastic right above the carina does not solve any pathologies that existed below that tube. So we still have to worry about those things, a pneumothorax, any physiological shunting, all of that, bronchial constriction, all still applies. So just because we get the patient intubated, we can't expect this magical escalation in their pulse oximetry. That's just probably not going to happen. And so what we do is exactly what you did. And we do carry ultrasound. Our first would be an end-tidal CO2 right on. So we can look at that waveform, goes right on the tube. We'll start making sure we're in the trachea. And then we got to make sure that we are in the right spot of the trachea. And you can use that with sliding signs with your ultrasound, auscultating lung sounds if you're not in a helicopter. If you're in a helicopter, you absolutely have to use ultrasound and look for your sliding on both sides. And then you don't see sliding on the one side. And so you said on the left side, you notice that you don't, and you have some air accumulation. You have a pneumothorax, and so you make a decision at that point that this is what the kid needs. And once you switch to positive pressure ventilation, you are going to exceed the space of that pneumothorax very fast, and we know that. So it's very important that we go ahead and we needle the chest, because typically what would happen if you did not do that is you could think, well, I just got to add PEEP, and you keep cranking your PEEP up thinking that there's some sort of VQ mismatch on the child, and then you end up really making that pneumothorax 10 times worse. And we know those consequences could be deleterious to that patient.
And we both talked about it. It's going through that methodical approach. You know, we removed the facts, we went through methodically and troubleshooted, and that's what we got. So, I mean, we went through all these cognitive stop points, and we kind of combined them, and that works out really well for us, and that's what we're realistically going to do. So let's kind of tie this in with a nice little happy ending, because we like happy endings. So, you know, pediatrician returns, has got the basically transfer all set up and helps you with the tube placement. You know, x-rays finally here, because x-ray always shows up later, and they take pictures. You got great tube placements. You know, ET tube looks great, chest tube looks great, kid's doing a whole lot better, and flight crew gets there, you know, just in time to get the patient out of there for you, and all goes well, because that's how it always works, right? The flight crew's the cavalry.
Yeah, I guess so. That's what they say, man.
All right. So, you know, we've talked about our cognitive stop points and all along the way. The keys are that you need to early on identify and call for help. Then you need to mobilize resources. You need to remove the assumptions and obtain facts. and then work in a methodical manner. And in most of these cases, in most patients, you are going to identify what was going on and correct it. And if not, you're probably going to still keep digging. And if you never quite get there, at least you're going to have additional resources, and they may have some ideas for you that you didn't think of.
Yeah. And you know, it's important that we practice this, and exactly what you and I are doing right now, where you sit down and you discuss this and you lay out a scenario and you go, okay, so what would you do at this point? Like you did in the beginning of this scenario, you said, Tyler, what's running through your mind? Maybe what's going through my mind might be completely different than yours. And while we start sharing these ideas, we start seeing different levels of thinking, different levels of discipline, what you might assume versus what I assume. And you don't have to actually run that call and to be in those situations in order to learn from that. And that's why I think there's a lot of benefit from discussing these calls and case reviews and actually saying, you know, this is what I thought. What do you think about this? Or you put up some vitals and you say, which one of these vitals worries you the most about the patient? Somebody might say diastolic blood pressure. One person might say respiratory rate. So it's really important that we kind of use simulation to practice these, but also just a very constructed conversation can do the same thing.
Yeah, no, could not agree with you more. And really, I think we have tied this episode up nicely. Thank you, Tyler, so much for coming on. Do you have any other final points?
No, it was a pleasure, Chip. I just want to commend you on your consistency, man. You have been a podcast producing machine. And I love it. I see that your episodes are coming out all the time. I listen to every single one. I think what you're doing is great. So keep it up, brother.
Well, thank you so much, Tyler. And actually, I listen to all of yours too. It is one of the best pre-hospital podcasts out there. In fact, if you are not listening to Tyler yet, you need to. And just because it's pre-hospital doesn't mean that it doesn't apply to us, because you go into a lot of the physiology and you go into a lot of the basics of the hardware. I mean, I know I'm doing this, but I know a lot of people who aren't. How many people that are listening, no matter what position you are, if you're a nurse, a paramedic, an EMT, a physician, a PA, an MP, it does not matter what your title is. Can you go through all the equipment in your department and work it? Do you know how to use the level one infuser? Do you know how to use the ventilator? Do you know where all the equipment is? Do you know where the backup for that equipment is? If you can't answer all that and run through the scenarios and figure out your other options and stuff like that, you're not a resuscitationist yet. You're not taking things seriously. And sometimes it's hard to find the actual resources on how to do that stuff. A lot of people you'll find in your department may not know, for example, how to use a level one infuser. It took me about a month or two to finally find someone who could actually teach me how to use it. But I made sure to learn it, and I've gone back to it and make sure that I can learn that concept. And I'm sure there are the same things that other people are thinking. The neat thing is, Tyler does a much better job than me about going through and talking about how to do that. How do you mix this type of medication? How do you get this type of stuff? So I'm plugging the hell out of your podcast here, Tyler.
I know, man. I'm blushing over here, dude. I know. You know what, man? I wouldn't say I do it better than you. We only have, you know, I wouldn't say a few, but we only have so much that we do pre-hospital with ventilators, cardiac monitors. And we don't have definitive treatments a lot of the time that they need. You know, we don't have a cath lab. We can't do surgery. So we really just try to get really good at what we have. And that way, when we are in these austere environments, when we are placed in situations where we have to think very fast and we really don't have a whole lot of other people to pull from except our crew and the people that are on scene with us, you want to try to simulate all these. And just like you work in that, you know, a hospital, I don't know if it's a critical access hospital. I think you said that in the past. You're working at these places where you don't have a whole lot of people to pull from. You really don't have time to go run and do a consult on the phone. You got to make these decisions fast. And so it works to take the equipment problems completely out of it and just be really good at that. And then we could just focus on taking care of the patient.
Better words cannot be said. I think we have to end it there, Tyler. So could you go ahead and give us the tagline?
Absolutely. This is Tyler Cristofoli from Foam Frat saying, continue to provide total care everywhere.